We lived in the US for 5 years, and it took me a ridiculously long time to understand their postal system. Our rented home had a little mailbox at the end of the yard and where letters would arrive. And on the side of the mailbox was a red lever. But I couldn't understand why it was there. It seemed that whether there was post arriving in it or not, the red lever would not change position. Further, there was a distinct lack of places to actually post mail. So I found myself often getting in a car and driving out to the central post office to deliver my mail. I was genuinely puzzled. Did Americans just not send letters? It was a few months in before I realized one morning that the mailbox at the end of our yard was for outgoing as well as incoming mail. I noticed my neighbor putting mail in it, and then he raised the red lever. It suddenly dawned on me that a raised red lever was to tell the postman that there was mail to collect. Every culture has its own set of rules, habits, and ways of doing life. If you grow up in that culture, then you innately adopt them. But if you're a visitor, a foreigner, it's natural if you do not always fit in with your new culture. Peter addresses readers here in chapter 2, verse 11, you'll notice, as foreigners and exiles. And he returns to a description he used in his opening words of chapter 1 to God's elect exiles scattered throughout the provinces of Pontus, Galatia, Cappadocia, Asia, and Bithynia. His choice of words reminds his readers that they are temporary residents in a foreign land. They are not to adopt the ways of the people that they live amongst. In verse 17 of chapter 1, Peter urges his audience to live their lives as people who are foreigners or sojourners, who are traveling to a better place. They need to realize that they're living outside the promised land in a similar way to the children of Israel. They're wandering through the desert of life with an eye on the promised land of heaven. 800 years or so after inheriting the promised land, the descendants of Israel lost it. They were swept into exile by the Assyrians and then by the Babylonians. And Jews in Peter's time still felt the pain of that loss. And many of them believed that they were still in exile under the occupation of the Romans. They longed for their own land back. But Peter is saying throughout chapter 1 to both Jews and Gentiles scattered throughout Asia Minor alike, that God is promising a new inheritance. He's now brought you into a new birth, into a new covenant, into a new relationship where the inheritance is no longer perishable like Canaan or Jerusalem. You are a new creation. You are the new Israel. So what exactly is this inheritance that Peter is talking about? Well, in a broad sense, it is land. Peter understood his readers to be strangers in this world waiting to get home to heaven. But in a narrower sense, it is status. We read there in verse 3 of chapter 1 that God has given us new birth into a living hope. And in verse 23 that you have been born again. Christians are born into a new status with the full rights of children, as Galatians 4 says. Peter then continues in chapter 2, and indeed throughout to the end of the book, with a clear injunction. Therefore, live as the chosen children of God. Live godly lives. Live a lifestyle worthy of the calling that you have received. Life may not be easy, even full of trials and tribulations, but nevertheless, our call is to live a life worthy of our status. You are, as chapter 2, verse 9 reminds us, a chosen people, a royal priesthood, a holy nation. You are priests, royal priests. You are to exercise your priesthood in living a life worthy of God, but also as servants. You are to follow in the example of Jesus himself, the suffering servant, And remember that Jesus came not to be ministered to, but to minister and to give his life a ransom for many. And as he came to serve and to love us, so we are to serve and love others. As we received mercy, we, verse 10, are to give mercy. Verses 11 through 20 of chapter 2, we're given here the principles to help us live godly lives in our workplaces. In verses 13 to 20, Peter helps us to think through how we relate to the boss, and we'll come to that next week. But let us notice this lunchtime, what Peter has to teach us about relating to our fellow colleagues. So notice first, lifestyle matters. We're all so aware of what people think of us, but some of us are more aware than others. I want to do a quick experiment with you. Now, I want you to extend the first finger of your dominant hand. Come on, all of you. Let's have this up. Now, you have got 5 seconds to trace a capital Q on your forehead. Go for it. Now, well done. Some people draw the Q on their head in a way that can be read by somebody facing them, with the tail on the left side of the forehead. Now, if you did that, you tend to be aware of how other people see you. You're almost certainly an extrovert, and you love being the center of attention. Other people draw the cue so they can read it themselves, with the tail on the right-hand side of their forehead. And if you did that, then you may well be an introvert, and maybe you are less concerned about what people think of you. It's just a bit of fun. The truth is, isn't it, is that we are all, whether introvert or extrovert, we are all looking for the affirmation of others. It's all well and good until that desire to be liked means that we compromise our true identity, that we take on a persona that is not true to who we really are. It's been my experience that often drive and ambition in work can lead Christians into situations and places that are not true to themselves. Now, we easily forget that we are sojourners and look to take up permanent residence in a place that we're not meant to settle. At the weekend, we live by our true set of values, and then from Monday to Friday, we adopt a foreign set of rules and habits. In your desire to be accepted, you need to remember your true identity. You draw your ethical standards not from this world, but from your home to come. You draw your guidelines for life from the Bible, not the workplace. Therefore, as verse 11 reminds us, we are to abstain from sinful desires. And we can see here in this verse both an internal and an external implication to this instruction. Notice that lifestyle matters for the good of your soul. Verse 11 explains that sinful desires wage war against the soul. Peter gives us here a vivid picture of the impact of wrong desires. They assault or they fight our soul. They endeavor to bring only harm, even to cause death. Desires are often the stuff of dreams. Yes, the things that we think of in our sleep, but also the things that motivate and drive us. And desire is a very powerful emotion. And it can be used for good, but it can also take control of us and bring destruction. The Bible repeatedly says that wherever possible, avoid placing yourself in the way of wrong desire. Avoid the occasion for sexual temptation, whether that's on the computer or whether that's in the workplace. Remember what the father tells his son in Proverbs about the wayward wife. Don't go near the door of her house. Her words will trap you. And I'm sure the father would say the same of a wayward husband. Flee youthful lusts, says James. And of course, there's this great example of Joseph doing just that when Potiphar's wife propositions him. You know, he didn't just stand around and discuss it with her. He ran out of the house. Charles Spurgeon once said that the answer to many temptation is a fast set of legs and the king's highway. But the Bible does not only speak of avoiding sexual desire. We are to resist greed, avoid gluttony, live soberly, and withstand all snares, temptations, and corrupt things. And we have an example of that in the story of the rich man and Lazarus in Luke 16, of a man there who lost his battle with desire. Incredibly, the rich man, despite the very fact that he is in hell, does not ask to get out. But instead, he continues to complain about his surroundings and bully Lazarus, the beggar, who he had bullied throughout life. And commentators have noticed the astonishing amount of blame shifting and spiritual blindness in this soul. He appears very lost. And commentators also note that the author only gives him the name Rich Man. It tells us that this man built his identity on the thing that he desired until it consumed him and it became him. And once he'd lost his wealth, he'd lost any sense of a self. Giving into sinful desire leaves its mark on our souls internally, but it also manifests itself externally in our appearance and demeanor. Notice also that lifestyle matters for the good of our outward appearance. In the Oscar Wilde novel, The Picture of Dorian Gray, the protagonist, Dorian, has his handsome face painted by an artist. And it coincides with him embracing a hedonistic lifestyle. And in a fit of pique, Dorian curses the photo because he fears it will forever remind him of his youthful good looks. He pledges his soul, if only the painting could bear the burden of age and loose living, allowing him to stay young forever. Dorian sinks into deeper and deeper into a lifestyle of sin, and yet his good looks remain. Every now and then he feels a sort of certain element of guilt, and he'll clamber upstairs into the attic where the picture is kept, and he'll pull back the blanket under which the picture, he sees something that is a reflection of his soul. And the picture reveals this bedraggled, weathered face that reflects the impact that his debauchery has had upon his soul. Wilde here gives us a brilliant picture of the impact that giving in to sinful desire has on someone's outward appearance. In a reversal of what might be expected, the young man retains his external good looks despite his wild living. Now, obviously, this is an extreme version, but the principle still stands. Do not think that you can hide the dark secrets of your heart. You may not speak of them openly, but they will show out by the way that you look and in the manner in which you act. You know, just like when someone's unhappy, sin has a way of making its way to the surface. It just leaks out. It will reveal itself in the office by the way you are with colleagues, and it will show up at home by the way you are with your husband or your wife and the way that you treat your kids. Lifestyle matters, but note, secondly, that lifestyle witnesses. Through the ages, Christians have made several mistakes about what it means to be a foreigner and sojourner in the world. One mistake that crops up from time to time is the one that some kind of visible difference between yourself and the world will make a difference. So, for example, having a particular hairdo or dressing in a certain way. And this kind of behavior sort of arises from a peculiar notion that the way in which you dress will demonstrate to the world that you're a follower of Christ. In fact, it just makes someone stand out for the wrong reason, for being odd. There's nothing like that in the New Testament. Peter and all the other apostles dressed like the people of their day. In verse 12, we're given the thing that will make a good impression on our work colleagues. We are to live good lives among them. And by this, Paul is not talking about a religious legalism, which leads to that kind of judgmental piety. He's not talking about a goody-goody at work that nobody can relate to. And in all honesty, people find irritating. He's rather being positive. He's saying, let your good deeds be a light to the workplace. And you know, while Peter certainly has in mind holiness, verse 14 expands on what is meant by living a good life. It shows us that its focus is on virtues that the culture itself should approve. In our relationship with colleagues, we should be known for our honesty, our punctuality, our timekeeping, our truth-telling, our loyalty, our commitment to work, and our reliability as a friend. We should not be known for being a gossip, for being ruthless, for being unreliable, for lying, for walking over people in the name of ambition. Now, you may work in a culture that allows those things to happen, but do not think that they are respected. They are simply endured. Our most powerful witness in the workplace is to be different, not by the way we dress, but by the way we respect and treat our fellow work colleagues. It's vital that we honor our work colleagues as God's creatures made in his image. We accordingly must treat them with human dignity, even if the same respect is not reciprocated. Yeah, let me say, do not be that work colleague who is naive. You are to be as gentle as a dove, but as wise as a serpent. You know, I worked for 12 years as a lawyer. I know that attaining that balance is extremely difficult, and it's something that you have to work on every day. In my time in America, I adopted many of their habits and cultural ways. I went out of my way to build relationships. I fitted in well and was accepted. Yet my accent never changed, and I was as English then as I am today. I was still a foreigner, but I didn't stick out for the wrong reasons. In truth, I really enjoyed being with my American friends, and they, I believe, enjoyed being with me. Now, when you're at work, you're in your colleagues' world, but you're not of their world. Stand out for good reasons, not for bad ones. Live godly lives that point to Jesus. By your lifestyle, witness daily to the living hope that you know and enjoy. Amen.